station of New Rock City, the place where you can enjoy a wholesome family entertainment experience.
Get your weather 24 hours a day, 7 days a week by calling the Whitney Radio Weather Phone at 914-636-7026, a service of Union State Bank. Now at Union State Bank, free checking, no monthly charges, no per check fees, just $100 to open at Union State Bank. Union State Bank sponsors the Whitney Radio Weather Phone at 914-636-7026. That's 914-636-7026.
Bob, good Thursday morning to you. Well, another dry July day on tap around the local listening area, even though it will turn increasingly more humid as we go through the day today. So turning more uncomfortable, but again, at least conditions will be dry. That'll change as we head into Friday. Better chance to see some shower and thunderstorm activity, and then as we head into this upcoming weekend, a cold front may stall right over the area, and that means we could be dealing with a couple of days of numerous showers and storms. Today, though, looking dry. Partly sunny, warm and humid with high temperatures well up into the 80s. Tonight, partly cloudy, muggy with lows in the 60s. Friday will feature partly sunny skies with some scattered showers and storms around during the afternoon. Definitely not a washout for your Friday with highs warm, middle 80s. Saturday, lots of clouds with occasional showers and storms. Highs right around 80. I think numerous showers and storms stay with us on Sunday with temps right around 80 once again. Unfortunately, wet weather will carry us into Monday as well with high temperatures on Monday in the upper 70s. For the Whitney Radio Network, WVOX and News 12 Westchester, I'm meteorologist Bryson Van Eck.
Thank you very much, Bryson. Coming up on 905, the temperature is 74.
The latest forecast from the 1460 WVOX Weather Center has been brought to you by Entergy and the Indian Point Energy Center. Right for New York.
What's right for New York? I'll tell you what's right for New York.
Nuclear power? Oh, it's right for New York. Definitely.
New Yorkers, take a new look at nuclear power.
It's right for New York because nuclear power doesn't pollute the air or contribute to global warming.
I didn't know that.
It's right for New York because we make it right here.
So it's not foreign energy.
Es correcta para Nueva York, totalmente.
Nuclear power produces homegrown electricity that's reliable.
It costs less than other sources of power. That's right for me.
And nuclear power is safe. For more than 30 years, the Indian Point Energy Center, now run by Entergy, one of the most respected and experienced nuclear operators in the country, has had an award-winning track record for safety.
It's right for New York because it means cleaner air for my family.
뉴욕에 알 맞습니다.
For other ways nuclear power is right for New York, visit the Indian Point Energy Center on the web at rightfornewyork.com. The Indian Point Energy Center.
It's right for New York.
It is now 9:06. Let's go to WVOX Westchester traffic with Craig Schenkman. Good morning, Craig.
Hey, Bob. Good morning. Thanks. A new accident happens east south, getting squared away. Right lane blocked. Also an accident north on I-87, right near exit 9 in Tarrytown. 287 eastbound delays exit 3 to exit 6, easing. Not bad as you make your way west on 287. Quiet on Metro North. No delays for the B line buses. This is Craig Schenkman. Shadow traffic, 1460, WVOX.
Thank you, Craig. We'll catch up with you tomorrow.
You got it. Take
care. The time
is
9:06 and change.
WVOX wins again. Whitney Radio's Westchester Community Station has again been honored by the New York State Broadcasters Association for outstanding news coverage. ABC's Barbara Walters presented WVOX with this year's Outstanding News Award for our coverage of the spring floods in Westchester.
Howard Parkway was 5+ feet of water.
Then the fireman came about 5 o'clock and said it's a mandatory evacuation because it was so high.
Senator, are you confident that we'll get the disaster declaration?
Oh, I believe we will.
The prestigious New York State Broadcasters Award will be added to our public service and editorial awards consistently won over the last 40 years.
We are working with our county and state and federal officials to try to have this area declared a federal disaster area.
When did the water peak, yesterday or today?
But it peaked at around 10 when the high tide came in.
The Wall Street Journal got it right. WVOX is America's quintessential community stations. Close to home, close to you, right here on 1460 and worldwide at WVOX.com.
The voice of Westchester, 1460 WVOX.
Hi there, good morning. Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates, on WVOX AM. My name is Richard Garfunkel, and I am the host of this weekly forum. The program is coming live from New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on the Long Island Sound, and it can be heard streaming live on www.wvox.com. One can also call directly to the station at 914-636-0110. Our guest this morning, and we're waiting for him to call in, is the distinguished journalist Jonathan Alter of Newsweek magazine and the NBC network. Mr. Alter is a frequent contributor on the NBC network, and his specialty is the American political arena. Mr. Alter, who was originally from Chicago, graduated from Harvard with honors and started with Newsweek in 1983. Since 1991, he's been a senior editor with Newsweek and has written a widely acclaimed column that examines politics, media, and delves into social and global issues. He is also the author of the book, The Defining Moment, FDR's First 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope, which was published by Simon & Schuster in May of 2006. The current paperback edition is currently out, and I recommend for you all to pick it up. Meanwhile, the mission of the advocates is bring to the public differing views on current public policy issues. Public policy, therefore, is what we, as a nation, legally and traditionally follow. Over the years, the public policy of the United States has changed or it has been modified greatly. As, per example, free public education is the public policy of the United States. Also, over time, great struggles have ensued over control of the direction of public policy. For example, free trade versus protectionism, slavery versus emancipation, states' rights versus federalism, and also an all-volunteer army, you know, versus the draft. That's more or less what we consider the debate in this country, and it's been going on, probably since George Washington's time. Personally, I have spent about 40 years reading and listening and writing about FDR and his legacy, and therefore, with a local reputation as a collector and specialist on FDR, I can say with all sincerity that I enjoyed Mr. Alter's book. I have the pleasure to talk and meet with him on the subject of his work, and therefore, in the wake of this historic anniversary of FDR's nomination in 1932, I'm glad that he can join us. And meanwhile, I'm still waiting on, waiting for his call, and I'm pretty sure it'll come through very soon. It's interesting when we talk about, FDR and his background. And of course, this period of time is, a very exciting period because, we're going through a tremendous amount of situations going forward. Is Mr. Alter there? Okay. John, Jonathan, are you available?
I am indeed.
Okay, very good. I was dancing there, and I'm glad you were able to cut in. As I said, and I think the audience knows and recognizes Jonathan Alter and his appearances all through the NBC network, and we've always been enjoyed his insightful remarks. Since he's here, and I know he has a limited schedule, I want to get right into it. And I want to frame this question by saying that in 1932, the convention was held in Chicago, and recently Mr. Alter has attended the 75th anniversary of the Democratic National Convention in 1932. And I know he was there, and a very exciting moment. But the first question I have for him is, why did you write this book about FDR, since there have been countless written before, and why the first 100 days?
Well, first of all, there have been many written before, but interestingly, it's been about 30 years since anybody really wrote anything that focused on the early part of FDR's presidency. Most books about FDR are either biographies, which go by at 150 miles an hour, or they're focused on World War II. And And books longer ago than 30 years, they tended to look at the first 100 days as the launching point for the New Deal, as the beginning of the story. And I decided to look at it, really for the first time, as the culmination of an exquisite piece of political theater on the part of Franklin Roosevelt. Its importance is really relevant for today, because my story is really about leadership and what it feels like to be in the presence of great leadership. And I argue that Roosevelt saved both capitalism and democracy in a very short period of time. Although quite a lot of the book is not about the first 100 days, I spend time, you know, setting it up and explaining where Franklin Roosevelt got the confidence from. And I have about a 60-page section that catches people up who haven't read about him before in a long time, about his early years with polio and his relationship with Eleanor. And then I get into the 1932 election, which, as you mentioned, we're at the 75th anniversary of, and then the famous first 100 days, which were in the early part of 1933.
Jonathan, would you say, and of course, just so our audience knows, Franklin Roosevelt actually flew to the convention, and very few people flew. In fact, he flew with his family, and it was a remarkable flight from Albany to Chicago, and he was the first to actually address a convention. Tell us a little bit about the 1932 convention. I know you frame it quite well, and most people don't remember or believe that it was not a foregone conclusion, his nomination. Could you tell us a little bit about how that came about, especially the two-thirds rule and what that indicated to the country in those days?
Well, in those days, to be nominated, you need two-thirds of the delegates. So there were many conventions that went more than one ballot. And indeed, Roosevelt's convention, it wasn't until the fourth ballot that he was nominated. In modern times, we haven't had more than one ballot since 1952. So, you know, the end of the two-thirds rule really kind of ended the idea of truly deliberative, important political conventions, because things are more kind of baked in the cake before the convention. But Roosevelt came in as the front runner because he had picked up a lot of rural delegates. But he was very unpopular in a lot of urban areas. Most of the bosses were with Al Smith, and he didn't control the New York delegation, even though he was the governor of New York. And so Jim Farley, his campaign manager, couldn't even get a seat in the New York delegation. Can you imagine Karl Rove not getting a seat in the Texas delegation? And the first couple of ballots went badly for Roosevelt, and there was no real history of anybody who came in as a front runner and lost strength, then coming back to win the nomination. So the fact that he was able to do so, which is a story I tell in the book, was a rather extraordinary political feat. A lot of it came down to a former Treasury Secretary under Woodrow Wilson, and indeed Wilson's son-in-law, a guy named William Gibbs McAdoo, who was a senator from California. And McAdoo and Al Smith, who had been the 1928 candidate for president, had battled in 1924 for 103 ballots at a convention that was held in New York City. And it was such a terrible thing for the Democratic Party, which lost that year to Calvin Coolidge, that McAdoo decided, even though he was initially opposed to Roosevelt and had cut a deal with Smith to stop Roosevelt, McAdoo decided in a very kind of complex set of maneuvers that he didn't want to put the Democratic Party through another torturous convention of 100 ballots or whatever it took, because they had a good chance of winning in 32. So he threw his support to Roosevelt, and I think that, more than putting John Nance Garner on the ticket or all the other things that various historians have attributed Roosevelt's victory to, I think it was really McAdoo who gave him the victory. As you mentioned, Richard, Roosevelt flew to Chicago and accepted his nomination in person, and I can imagine people going, well, yes, so what? But this was only 5 years after Lindbergh flew across the Atlantic. And so when Roosevelt landed in Chicago, there was this tumultuous welcome. A lot of people weren't sure whether he was going to make it or not. He had originally had 13 passengers aboard, and he bumped one because he was superstitious, and he didn't know what speech he was going to give when he got to the convention, because his aide, Louis Howe, pressed an entirely different draft into his hand, and on the way in from the airport, there was no time to freshen up. He went right to the convention hall and delivered his famous New Deal for America speech, and it was the first time in American history that a candidate had accepted his nomination in person. It's kind of hard for us to imagine, but until that point, there was this, what Roosevelt called, silly tradition of what was called a notification ceremony, where party elders would go and tell you, notify you in your hometown that you were the nominee of your party, and you'd never actually appear at the convention, which in the television age for us now is unimaginable, but that's the way it worked until 1932. And thereafter, of course, we've had acceptance speeches at the convention.
Well, you know, it's interesting just to frame what you said in that, and in your remarkable book, which you bring so much personality to. In the convention, Roosevelt came in with 666 delegates, which was more than a majority, but the magic number was 770. And what you explained so well was that the Southern delegations controlled the convention. They were afraid of being dominated by the Northerners. In fact, the Republicans in their GOP conventions had eliminated the two-thirds rule a number of years earlier. This would be the last convention where the two-thirds rule was enforced. And as you said, after that, of course, Roosevelt was nominated again three more times, and then Truman, etc. But it's also interesting that this really was maybe the foreshadowing of the breaking of the Solid South, which would come later in 1948 with the Dixiecrats, etc., and then with the Nixon Southern strategy. So it's interesting how the two-thirds rule was really to almost keep the Southern Democrats with a type of veto over who would be the nominee.
Well, that's really interesting. I had never actually thought of it quite that way, that was the beginning of the breaking of the Solid South. That's what I depend on you for, Richard, because that is not in my book, that point. It's a very, very good one.
And here's something I picked out of your book, which I loved, and I know because you're a reporter and you've had the exquisite experience of speaking to the greats and the near greats. My second question relates to your work as a reporter, and it goes off a bit on this, but you put in a priceless vignette of how FDR chastised reporters with his dunce cap situation. And in your research, did you find his give and take much different than today's reporters with his successors? In other words, how much was the public exposed to the presidency through the media in the late 20s and the early New Deal as comparison today in your experience?
Well, I have a chapter on this because I found it so interesting. You know, Hoover and Coolidge and Harding, to a certain extent, required questions in writing. And they'd give a few interviews to favored reporters, but mostly there was very little access. So when Roosevelt became president, he announced that he would hold two press conferences a week in the Oval Office. Now, this is an extraordinary thing if you think about nowadays. You know, if there's one presidential press conference every 6 weeks or 2 months, it's considered pretty, you know, good. And sometimes presidents will go 6 months without holding a press conference. So, you know, two a week was amazing, and one for the morning papers and one for the afternoon papers. They did not allow radio in there, so there was a different kind of give and take with the reporters, and indeed they were on background, so you had to get permission from the White House in order to print what the president said. But it was a tremendous level of access, and there was a lot of give and take and a lot of joshing, and Roosevelt was kind of like the teacher, and he would joke with the reporters. At one point, as you mentioned, he told a reporter for the New York Post to go sit in the corner with a dunce cap on his head because of a question that he asked. But as usual, you know, Roosevelt said that with a kind of a jovial air about him, and I have some wonderful descriptions by the reporters of what it was like to be in there with Roosevelt and how he would kind of, you know, he was sitting at his desk because, of course, it was uncomfortable for him to stand, and he would kind of crane his neck around a group of reporters, find somebody at the back of the pack, and then bore in on them and listen intently to their question, and you felt like you were the most important person in the world when you were asking him a question. And it kept him on his toes, and to have to face the press twice a week. This is something that people don't understand about presidential press conferences. They're good for the president as well as the press. You have to find out what's going on in your own government in order to respond to these questions. And Roosevelt was intensely curious about what was happening both in the world and inside his own government in the United States, and he used those press conferences to share the fruits of his curiosity with the country and to go over the heads of the publishers, who were generally anti-Roosevelt, but he knew that the reporters liked him, in part because he provided so much access. And it was such a change, Richard, that first day, in that first week of March 1933, when he announced he'd hold two a week. It was such a change, such a breath of fresh air, that the reporters actually applauded at the end of the press conference, which would be unimaginable today.
We're talking to Jonathan Alter, who has written a great book and is coming out in paperback, and I urge you all to take a look at it and, I think, buy it and read it. You'll learn a lot, called The Defining Moment, FDR, and His First 100 Days, and the politics of hope, basically. I think what is so remarkable about how what Jonathan Alter has related is that these two press conferences a week really kept him on his toes. It kept him sharp. It kept him, you know, with the give and take. And these were free-flowing. And I can just imagine the scene of some reporter asking a silly question, like the guy who asked Don Larson after his perfect game, was this the best game you ever pitched? And, I mean, I still quote that, and it's 50 years ago, and it certainly was the greatest game ever pitched against one of the great franchises in history. Can you imagine FDR looking at a reporter and say, God, that's a dumb question. Put on a dunce cap and go in the corner.
But he did it without being, you know, mean. I mean, he could be cold sometimes to various people around him, particularly people in his own family. But he had an effervescence, you know. Churchill compared meeting him to opening a bottle of champagne, and there was a quality to him where you liked being in his presence, and you felt better about him, even if he was, about yourself and about the country, even if he was telling you to go sit in the corner with a dunce cap.
We have a caller. Let's hear what this caller has to say for a moment.
Richard, yeah. Jonathan, it's Linda Garfunkel.
Oh, I have my loyal wife calling in. Very nice.
Jonathan, I have a question for you.
Okay.
Using FDR as a model for the first 100 days, what do you think the next president of the United States should do on January 20th, 2009, to gain the confidence of the American people and to raise the status of the United States in the world back to where it used to be?
Well, I think that, like with Roosevelt, there's no one thing to do. It's not as if Roosevelt, you know, just closed the banks and that was how he regained people's confidence. But most of the banks were already closed. And so it was a series of things, and he had 15 major pieces of legislation that went through Congress in the first 100 days with, you know, greater and lesser degrees of amendment that didn't all go sailing through. But what he was able to do symbolically and substantively was convince the country that he represented what he called in his inaugural address action and action now. And he mentioned that word action five times. And it really was, in some ways, at the time, more important than the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, because that line was inspired, but in some ways it was inspired nonsense, because if you were worried about how to put food on the table, you know, you had more to fear than fear itself. So I think the new president, for whom the 100 days will be tremendously important, as they have been for other successors to FDR, will need to take both substantive and symbolic action to show the nation and the world that it's a new day. And the sharper the break with the past, the easier it will be to convince the country and the world that it's a new day. And some of it will just be, you know, the identity of that person. I mean, to give you just an example without, you know, making the case for somebody like Barack Obama, there's been some criticism of the fact that his middle name is Hussein. But if the United States was to elect a president named Barack Hussein Obama, it would be mind-blowing in the rest of the world, and I think it would help to, you know, suggest to the rest of the world that it was a new day. And, of course, a lot of it would be up to President Obama or President Clinton or President Edwards or whoever gets in there, if it's a Republican, you know, to show that we were breaking with the past. And I think that's one of the problems, frankly, with the idea of President Giuliani is he talks about putting people in like John Bolton, the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, as one of his foreign policy advisors. Well, that doesn't represent a new day for the rest of the world. So part of it, this is a long-winded way of saying that part of it represents, it's a psychological break. And that's what Roosevelt offered from Herbert Hoover, even though several of the policies were the same as what Hoover was pursuing. It still, in total, represented a strong break from that path.
We have another caller, but before I go to it, I want to frame a question for Jonathan Alter, talking about FDR in his book, The Defining Moment. And I'll go to this call, but I want him to think about this because I think this is very critical today. You mention in your book his relationship with Frank Capra of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington fame and It's a Wonderful Life, one of the great directors in history. And Capra started a Why We Fight series to inform the American public about what we were fighting for during World War II. And do you see any parallels to this today? And do you believe that this administration has failed in its ability to explain to the American people its current effort and sacrifice? I want to take this call, and I know you're going to have some limited time, and maybe you'll get back to us in between. But let's hear what this caller has to say.
Good morning. It's Mr. Cam from New Rochelle.
Yes.
I hope it's not too limited here. I want to raise the issue of whether Roosevelt deserves the credit for ending the Depression. I think Republicans have rewritten history on this, as they have on so much of this era. According to the figures I've seen, unemployment got down to 6% before the beginning of World War II. This is quite respectable, and of course it started off at 25, and that was only the official count of unemployment. So in other words, he used the money supply, the way Democrats always do, and increased it to stimulate the economy and bring it back to normal.
Let me interrupt for 1 second. I know we're going to have to go for a break. I want to answer that. It's a good point. In fact, unemployment was at 30%. In fact, the economy in 1933 was only 17%. The stock market value, Dow Jones, was only 17% of what it was in late 1928, early 1929. And if you include, and this is what Gene Edward Smith in his new book brings in, very important issue, that if you include CCC and WPA and PWA, in actuality, the unemployment rate was 4%. And if you took away government jobs today, state, local, and federal, you could imagine where unemployment would be. We have to have a quick break, I believe. Is that right? And then we'll come back to Jonathan on this question about why we fight, etc. Thank you.
The Metro Golf Show celebrates its 100th program this Saturday with a very special show. Hi, I'm Tom Merriam. Join Bill Meth and me as we broadcast the 100th Metro Golf Show live from America's oldest golf club, St. Andrews in Hastings, Saturday morning at 8 o'clock here on WVOX-AM and WVOX.com. Our special guests will include Roger Clemens, the New York Yankees future Hall of Famer, who talks about his love of golf. Port Chester's own LPGA sensation Megan Francella will give the tip of the week. So, for the 100th time, tune in this Saturday and every Saturday at 8 a.m. to what the New York Daily News calls the best local radio show covering golf, the Metro Golf Show on WVOX and WVOX.com. The Metro Golf Show is sponsored in part by Classics of Golf, the Barclays, the Mohegan Sun, and Green Mountain Coffee.
WVOX and WVIP. Now, there are two all together.
unique radio stations in the New York area. One absolutely extraordinary theme. One guiding principle, where many different voices are heard in the land. WVIP and WVOX. For you and yours. 1460 WVOX and 93.5 WVIP. Two great New York area radio stations. Separate, but very much alike. 1460 and 93.5.
It started some years ago on Long Island when two gifted interior designers who just happened to be sisters, Mary Middlemiss and Nancy Rutigliano, combined their resources and remarkable talents to create twice as nice interiors. The sisters and their unique design service have today become famous for their tasteful work among substantial and discerning individuals and clients in Westchester, Manhattan, the Hamptons, the North Shore, who now rely on them to redo primary residences, country homes, and in-town apartments. As designers, Mary and Nancy quite understand that decorating a home, an office, or apartment can be a pretty frustrating and draining process. Twice as nice interiors makes it easy. And unlike many so-called decorators, the sisters, each possessed of a keen eye and exquisite taste, ensure that the rooms you have in mind reflect your personality and accommodate your family's lifestyle. They specialize in sensible floor plans, lighting, fabric, wallpaper, paint and color coordination, plus bathroom and kitchen layouts and marble, granite, and tile selection, all at reasonable decorator prices. It's called Twice as Nice Interiors, created by those two talented and designing sisters from Long Island. Call Mary or Nancy at 631-581-9291. 631-581-9291 or visit twiceasniceinteriors.com.
Hear the latest up-to-date Westchester weather reports at the top of each hour on 1460 WVOX. WVOX's exclusive weather reports with meteorologist Steve Pelletieri, brought to you by Entergy and the Indian Point Energy Center, right for New York. It's the third leading cause of death in the U.S., but would you recognize the symptoms of a stroke? Sudden onset of numbness or weakness in the face, arm, or leg. Confusion. Trouble speaking or understanding. Trouble seeing in one or both eyes. Difficulty walking, dizziness, loss of balance or coordination. Severe headache with no known cause. Since treatment within 3 hours of the onset of symptoms reduces the risk of long-term disabilities or death, the New York State Designated Stroke Center at Sound Shore Medical Center in New Rochelle urges anyone experiencing or observing these symptoms in others to seek emergency medical attention immediately.
This program is brought to you by the Westchester County Press, founded in 1928. The County Press is today the only black-owned newspaper in the northern suburbs. Published every week, the County Press is a lively, provocative journal that speaks to the issues and concerns of African-American families of substance and means. This unique publication delivers an upscale, successful, and highly influential readership base for any suburban advertising or marketing campaign. Featuring the irreverent musings of star feature columnist Snoopy Allgood and the thoughtful pronouncements of longtime activist M. Paul Redd, the County Press is one of Westchester's most valuable assets. For advertising and subscription information, an entire year for just $25, call 914-684-0006 or send your check for $25 to the Westchester County Press, Box 152, Elmsford, New York. The number for the publisher and Oriel Redd, the editor, is 684-0006.
1460 WVOX Westchester.
Hello there, Richard Garfunkel. We're back with Jonathan Alter of Newsweek. I know he's on a tight time schedule. I'd like to bring him back on the radio, reflective of this question on Frank Capra and why we fight and what his perspectives are today and the message that should be given to the public. Jonathan?
Well, I think it's actually too late make the cause for why we fight, as Frank Capra did during World War II. You know, the Iraq War has gone on now longer than World War II already. You have to have, if you're doing a propaganda film, which Why We Fight those short films were all, you know, U.S. propaganda films, you still have to have something to sell. And you can't sell lies. Propaganda as lies only works, in a closed society like the Soviet Union or Communist China or in the old days or what have you. You know, so if the Bush administration could have gotten the best propagandists possible, the latter day Frank Capras, and if they said that, as President Bush said again this week, that Al Qaeda in Mesopotamia is the same group that attacked us on 9/11, it's a lie. And if they put it in a propaganda film, it would be the job of all of us to expose that it was a lie. What Frank Capra was doing was explaining the deeper reasons we were in World War II. It wasn't a lie, and it inspired people like my own father, who flew many missions over Nazi Germany.
So in other words, it isn't, I think, possibly the boat was missed, assuming the justification for the war was real. In other words, today it's closing the barn door after the cows have left, and no matter what you're saying, and I think generally speaking, the vast amount of thinking Americans understand that this may possibly be an incredibly lost cause.
Well, it is. It's not may. It is a lost cause. I mean, you know, it's a salvage operation at best right now.
Right.
There are no good options left. I was for this war, Richard. I believed Colin Powell when he went to the United Nations. We now know, and Colin Powell has admitted, that pretty much everything he said in that speech in the United Nations was untrue. He talked about mobile biological warfare labs in Iraq. It turned out that was the figment of a fabricating defector's imagination, which the United States, a lot of people in the United States government had reasons to suspect him. He was never actually interviewed by the CIA. He was in German hands, and he was a liar, and we went to war largely based on his lie.
We have another
curveball, by the way.
Yeah.
His code name was Curveball, and everybody should be familiar with how that happened.
We have another caller, but I want to ask one more question for you quickly to get back onto your book and FDR. Our generation knows FDR as the first great communicator as president. He was the first president to use radio effectively, was seen countless times on newsreels, which served about 90 million people who attended movies weekly in America as their form of, almost their form of television. You described the first fireside chats and how Robert Trout of CBS News, you're a little younger than I am, and I was up all night listening to the convention from San Francisco, Cow Palace, with JFK, and Robert Trout was on, and then he later announced on Election Day the victory, and I listened to that to early in the morning, so I remember Robert Trout quite well. He introduced them. How would you gauge their early impact on the American public, and how many people listened to the chats?
Well, first of all, I have so much respect for you as a historian. I'm going to risk quibbling with you. JFK was actually nominated
Los Angeles, pardon me, you're right.
Yeah, in Goldwater at the Cow Palace
four years
later in San Francisco in 1964. And I also want to very quickly address the earlier caller. I'm actually not one of those people who believes that Roosevelt ended the Depression with his fiscal policies and his money supply policies. Unemployment went up to 19% in 1937. You know, it had come down, obviously, from 25 or 30%, but it really didn't get into single digits, by my calculations, until we became the arsenal of democracy on the eve of World War II. So I do agree with the more conventional view that we really didn't come out of the Depression fully until World War II. But in answer to your question, I was absolutely fascinated by how that first fireside chat on March 12, 1933, transformed all communication in human history, that it was a kind of a transformative effect, event in the whole history of the relationship between leaders and their people. You got to remember that for thousands of years, before the invention of the microphone, a leader would have to talk to his people like this so that he could be heard at the back of the auditorium, you know, without the microphone. And then in the 20s, the microphone comes in, and what Bing Crosby did for singing, which was this, you know, intimate relationship with the audience through song, FDR did for the spoken word, and the intimacy that we now see as central to effective broadcasting, the conversational tone really began with FDR's fireside chats. And so I read hundreds of letters in the Roosevelt Library that basically said the same thing. I felt like you were sitting in my living room talking to me. Now, that's a totally different kind of experience than people before had had with their leaders. And he addresses them as my friends. I mean, unless you go back to Shakespeare's, you know, friends, Romans,
countrymen,
which
right.
probably didn't actually get said by Mark Antony. You know, generally, you didn't really talk to your people that way. Certainly, other leaders in the world were not addressing their people as friends and in that kind of conversation.
And the irony is Franklin Roosevelt did not have a lot of friends.
He had a very small circle. He was kind of like Ronald Reagan that way, in that except Ronald Reagan's wife was his best friend, and that was not the case with Franklin. And, but, you know, he was more intimate with the American people than he was with those in his circle.
We have a couple of callers. Maybe we can get a couple in quickly and see what's on their minds. Go ahead, please.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes. My name is Ken.
Ken. Okay, yes.
All right, now listen, let's get something straight here. That there was a strong indication when Pearl Harbor occurred, President Roosevelt knew all about it before a month before time, so it was no sneak attack.
No, that's a farcical answer. That's been debunked. Let me answer that claim. I know that's been debunked, but you made a statement.
Let me talk. President Roosevelt knew about Pearl Harbor before it happened, a month before time. He wanted to put the country back to work through for defense reasons. You got that right?
No, I don't believe that in the least. I think if you read At Dawn We Slept by... if you read Dawn, At Dawn We Slept and a million other, this has been totally debunked. This is ridiculous. FDR loved the Navy. He would have never wanted to see it attacked, etc. In fact, Pearl Harbor was on complete alert as of November 1st. All the commissions that follow it understood that, etc. That's kind of inflammatory talk.
Well,
that's
also,
ridiculous.
I mean, it doesn't, you know, it's amazing because I confront this all the time. People love these conspiracy theories. And you know, I'm happy to consider any of that stuff, but nobody has presented any evidence. And also, why would they not have, if they thought that an attack was coming, let's just say that the caller's right. Let's just assume for the sake of argument. They had a couple of battleships that were out at sea at the time of the Pearl Harbor attack. And
aircraft
were,
carriers.
Were
yeah.
spared, some carriers, excuse me.
Right.
Why wouldn't they have had the bulk of the fleet out at sea at that time? Why let instead the bulk of the fleet be destroyed at Pearl Harbor? And also, why would FDR want to have a two-front war? His interest was in fighting the Nazis at that time, his primary interest. Why would he, you know, want to? He wasn't itching for a fight with the Japanese right then.
Yeah, that's sort of silly. The whole idea of it, first of all, no one believed that with the shallow water at Ford Island and Pearl Harbor that torpedoes that would go 80 feet deep into the mud would ever hit the ships. In fact, that was a problem that Kimmel didn't have a torpedo net set up to protect these old battleships, which were all old enough to vote. The attack by the British on the Italian fleet at Taranto by one aircraft carrier with 18 planes using the what they called the Fairy Swordfish, which was a biplane that flew at 90 miles an hour with small 18-inch torpedoes, sunk three Italian battleships. That's where the Japanese figured it out. They put wooden fins on their torpedoes. That enabled them to run shallowly and be effective in Pearl Harbor. This planning didn't go back 10 years. They didn't have the technology. But in truth, FDR had, there was a war alert all over the Pacific and specifically in Pearl Harbor, and all the commissions found Short and Kimmel liable on it, no matter how much their supporters fought. We have another call. Let's get to a call. Go ahead, please.
Hi, it's Lou Pearlman in Washington.
Go ahead, Lou.
We live in a media environment today, which is voracious, to put it mildly. And you've pointed out many times that Roosevelt was a very private person. Kept things very close to his vest. I just wonder what Jonathan and you think about whether Roosevelt, or how or whether Roosevelt could function in the kind of paparazzi media world that we live in today, where everybody has to know everything about everybody all the time. And, you know, or even if he would want to, if he would be attracted to politics, if the price had to be such intense inquiry.
I think that's a great question for Jonathan, because he's right at he's in the belly of the beast. He knows that. He's right there. What do you think on that?
I have a kind of an unconventional view about this. First of all, I think Roosevelt would have wanted it anyway. He was intensely ambitious. He wanted to be president from a pretty early age. And I think his personal life was less important to him than his political career, as we found in 1918 when he had the affair with Lucy Mercer and was deeply in love with her. And Louis Howe said, from Eleanor, that'll be the end of your political career. So he broke it off with Lucy Mercer. Now, some people say, well, it was because she was Catholic and couldn't get... couldn't marry a divorced man, but I think they would have worked it out if that was really his priority. His priority was politics, and nowadays, as far as his disability goes, I think he would have skillfully turned it into an asset. He would have gone on Oprah and just discussed in an open and charming way how he overcame polio, and I don't think that the fact that he was... handicapped would handicap him nowadays in American politics. I think his assets would have outweighed that liability, and we also don't have the same stigma nowadays that we did then. It was a horrible stigma. Nowadays, if you look at something like Bob Dole's bad arm or the lawyer who defended Bill Clinton in the impeachment trial, Charles, spacing on his last name, but he did the whole thing from a wheelchair. Nobody blinked. So I think that FDR would have been able to cope with the various intrusions, but it would have been harder for him to run the White House as a kind of an old-fashioned hotel where various women that he liked came in and out at various times. It would have cramped his style a little bit, although, as we found out from Bill Clinton, he could have done some things in secret as well if he had been a little better at keeping secrets.
Well, I think, it's an interesting comment on accessibility. Samuel Morrison, the famous naval historian and author of the 12-volume history of naval operations in the Second World War, FDR had appointed him as a former professor from Harvard to chronicle World War II, said about FDR that if he had never been elected president, he would have been famous as a collector. And to extrapolate out of that, if Franklin Roosevelt had served one day in office and had died of a stroke on March 5th, he would have been famous for running for office without being able to run. And in fact, at that period of time, a lot of the icons were reflective of Franklin Roosevelt, the man at the helm, showing him in the Roosevelt clock, the wheel of state, handling it. So the fact that he could run as a polio victim, and remember at the time when he opened up and tried to develop a cure for polio at Warm Springs, half the people who had polio in the United States committed suicide during, sometime obviously ended their life that way. So polio was a stigmata that was incredible. People were put away.
But it's important. A lot of people think that nobody at the time knew Roosevelt had polio. And in fact, it was widely known that he had polio. And in some ways, it worked in his favor because of, paralyzed people felt that if he could walk, they could. The thing that was untrue was the idea that he was walking again. And that was a deception that they essentially foisted on the American public with the help of the media. But the idea that he, was crippled was public knowledge at the time.
Well, there's no doubt about it, and I think you're right. I think Roosevelt, in today's lexicon, he would use his disability in a very strategic and, I think, politically advantageous way. In those days, you're also right that he, overcoming this great disability, and remember, polio was not limited to a few hundred or even a few thousand people. It was a scourge that involved tens of thousands and even hundreds of thousands. In 1953, there was a tremendous polio scare here in Westchester, and most of the young boys, I was in day camp. I actually think it was 52 or 51. My mother took me out because there was such a terrible epidemic of polio. And
Richard, I've got to
go ahead.
I've got to run. Actually, that's a line that FDR playfully liked to say when he was bringing an interview or something to an end. He'd say, "Gotta run." Always got a good laugh out of that.
I thank you very much. It was a distinct honor and pleasure to have you sharing your thoughts. And I hope we can get you back here talking about more current things that you engage so well. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Richard.
My pleasure. Bye-bye. Hopefully we'll have a couple of more calls. We have a couple of minutes, and I think what is interesting for the public, certainly myself and the people I know, it's interesting to read history and learn from it. There's been many profound statements over the years about people who forget history. It'll come back to bite them. And, that's what Santayana basically said, George Santayana, the historian. those who forget history will be condemned to repeat it. Franklin Roosevelt's time and the first 100 days was chronicled quite effectively by William Lichtenberg in his book In the Shadow of FDR, which was written in 1983. I don't think things have changed today. I think that basically what Lichtenberg was saying is that the eight presidents who followed FDR in those days basically tried to model, either in a positive or negative sense, what the 100 days was about. In other words, people now expect someone to come into office. Pardon me. And in fact, Nancy Pelosi, when she came in as Speaker of the House, tried to recreate this 100 days atmosphere. We have another call on the line. Please go ahead. We have a few minutes.
Good morning. The polio epidemic was 1945 in that fall.
No, that's incorrect. Please give me your name.
I'll tell you why.
Please give me your name, too. Please give me your name.
Nudge.
No, back to Nudge. We had you last week. There were a number of...
May I tell you why I say that?
Sure, go ahead.
My son got a polio that year. That year, there was an epidemic in New Jersey, and we were told to keep our children in your own survive place and don't go elsewhere, and I did that. He was the first one to get it in Larchmont, 1945 in September.
I know, but there were also, you may have forgotten, but there were polio epidemics in the early 1950s. I can recall being taken out of camp, but it may have been a greater epidemic in 1945.
That's right.
I understand that. Basically, the bottom line to this, and I thank, it's wonderful to have a guy, a terrific personality like Jonathan Alter on, who has written so entertainingly about this period. Franklin Roosevelt has been written about in our literature. Approximately 1,000 books have been written. In fact, at one time, 15 or 20 years ago, Lincoln was the most written about man in the world. Franklin Roosevelt's, the chroniclers and biographers of Franklin Roosevelt passed that quite a bit of time ago. And there have been a number of books that have come out, quite some better known than others, some very specific, some very general. Recently, of course, Gene Edward Smith, a very respected historian, has written a wonderful one-volume history of FDR. But I think where Jonathan Alter scores dramatically is his ability to frame the times, especially focusing on the how the nomination came about. Things weren't so sure in those days. First of all, there were only six primaries. Most of it was state conventions, and maybe we ought to go back to that. It's possible. Roosevelt had a setback in the Massachusetts convention when Mayor Curley put himself on the ballot, even though he was under indictment. Roosevelt and Smith, in a state that was dominated by Irish Catholic voters, beat Roosevelt. So it's interesting. He Alter frames this period, discusses it in depth, and gives quite a bit of his knowledge of today. Jonathan Alter is not just a historian. He is certainly a current and important commentator on events. This is the kind of history that I think we all should engage in. This is how we learn to deal with the events coming forward. I thank you very much for spending some time with us. Richard Garfunkel, The Advocates. Hope to see you next week, the same time, same station at 9 a.m. Thank you very much.